Your name, sir.
Yes, hey Dick, it's Gordon here, W2TTT in Bergenfield, New Jersey. The variant of the question, I've seen some stuff on Tower Talk on this, and it's somewhat inconclusive in my judgment, but given a choice between having radials in, let's say, only two or three directions, and having them in, you know, buried in the ground versus in the air, as I can, if I elevate my antenna, I can get many more radials in all directions, and I'm wondering if that makes a big difference, and, you know, does it matter much if they're sloped down? In fact, I would think that they'd sloping them down would probably be okay, because it helps bring the match to closer to 50 ohms, but I was just wondering your opinion. In other words, the choice between eight radials all the way around in the air versus, let's say, four or six in the dirt. Your thoughts?
Yeah, there's two or three things going on here at once, and that's part of the confusion. I'm hoping to dispel a little bit of the confusion here. Here's what's going on. First of all, I believe the majority of what Jerry did on the series of articles I read was very small vertical antennas. And if you study Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and most issues except the first issue, it's always Chapter 4, and the very first edition, it's Chapter 3. But there's a series of curves in there, beautiful series of curves, that represent man months of work of somebody making real measurements on real wire, and give you all these beautiful curves. You go to the set of curves with the diameter of your wire, and you calculate things in phase length in degrees. In other words, a quarter wave antenna is 90 degrees long, and you enter the curve for 90 degrees, and you'll find out on one graph it tells you the resistive component, on the other graph it tells you the reactive component. For every single reasonable length and every single reasonable diameter of wire, or even caged wire, that you're likely to use. So you know what the impedance is going to be. Once I work with those set of curves every single day, because my main employer wants antennas smaller and smaller, and he wants to ram them into all kinds of tiny little places, and he wants full performance out of them, and I'm the guy that's trying to create that. I'm trying to tell him where the laws of physics won't let him go any further, but that's another whole story. The bottom line is that when you make the antenna smaller than desired, that's what Jerry was doing, the resistive component goes down at a moderate speed. The reactive component becomes highly capacitive, reactive, very fast. Now, if I take the length of antennas that Jerry is working with, quite often his radiation resistance, his resistance component of his short antenna, particularly the one his wife is sitting in the lawn chair underneath his umbrella, which really is the antenna, that thing probably had a radiation resistance of around 2 ohms. When Jerry does a good job, that's the resistive component. The reactive component he cancels by putting a series inductor somewhere to get rid of the capacitor reactor. He makes the reactance go to zero, but the resistive component is what he's loading his power into. He's got a 50-ohm transmitter, he's got an impedance-matching device somewhere, and he's loading all of his power into 2 ohms. Therefore, by definition, his current into that antenna is fiercely higher. A 2-ohm antenna versus a 50-ohm antenna, 25-to-1 ratio, he had 25 times more current. So now look what's going on. He's got a short antenna close to the ground, 25 times more current going into it. Therefore, he's got a fierce magnetic field close to the ground. Therefore, a zillion radials in close, in his particular case, is required. He's really got to shield that ground from all that RF energy, because if it couples into the ground, it considers the ground Earth as dummy load. Once the RF energy gets coupled in, it gets turned into heat. By the laws of conservation of energy, when you turn your valuable RF energy into heat, it's gone forever, and ain't nobody ever going to listen to it. It ain't going to move an S-meter when you heat up the ground locally. So that's part of what he's going on. Bear in mind also that you're laying down these radials to act like this perfect mirror for the other half of the dipole. If you have the real estate and you can hang your vertical antenna a half wave in the air, you make it a full half wave dipole, vertically polarized, fed in the center, no radials at all are required. So if you happen to have a tower that's tall enough or a tree that's tall enough, on 40 meters, many of us can do that, and you hang a pure vertical antenna, not only is your antenna further off the ground, that's good, not only does it no longer require those zillion radials, not only are you trying to synthesize by mirror phenomena the other half of the dipole, put the real other half of the dipole there. So if you have the resources, consider that. But if you don't have the resources, you love the antenna down close, you don't have a way of hanging it up high, then yes, the number of radials you're going to lay down is important, as the antenna is electrically shortened, mechanically shortened, the close-in radials become more and more important. I think that's part of what's going on. And so in Jerry's case, he looks like he needed 120 radials, and if I wasn't shrinking the antenna, I don't think that many radials is required. But that's an opinion. Let me pass it over to Mel, and then we'll pass it over to other people to see what he thinks, what you guys think. You're the guys that helped us with all this jazz. The blind's leading the blind here a little bit. K2KEY, who's not blind, K2RIW TechNet. You got it, Mel.
Right, this is K2KEY. All right, I've got the exact quote out from Jerry Civic. This is to, in reference to what we were talking about, shunt-feeding towers. Is this what I'm, we're still on, Dick, shunt-feeding towers? Because I'm going to get his quote out. I have it here for shunt-feeding, Dick, over.
Okay. Whether the tower is too short or whether the antenna thing that you make out of aluminum is too short, most of what we're talking about, you go to those curves, the impedances are fairly similar. In other words, if I'm making an aluminum pole as a vertical antenna and I expand it to a great big tower as an antenna, the difference is a very minor difference in resistance, a little bit more difference in reactance. If you're feeding it at the base or if you're shunt feeding it, that's just the impedance matching device. Once you're beyond coupling your power by whatever means you like, whether you feed the base or shunt feed, almost doesn't matter. That's just impedance matching. I will admit that you feed the base and you're going to see something like 2 ohms on a short antenna. You do the right kind of shunt feeding with some kind of a gamma-like device or a delta-like device, you will see higher impedances, and therefore it is easier to feed. But in either case, the vertical chunk of thing, whether it be tower, aluminum, or whatever, that resonates, that's what's creating the current, that's what's creating the field, that's what's creating that which radiates, and that field, if it's a short device, in other words, you didn't make it full length, I'm saying you've got a lot more current at the base, no matter how you fed it, a lot more current in the resonating structure, therefore a lot more magnetic field close to the ground, therefore the close-in radials, a whole lot of them in close becomes more important. That's my opinion, and you may see it slightly differently. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah. Well, this is actually the quote in his experiment that was done with, I got the whole information here of what kind of tower it was, what kind of antennas it was on, and all, and he basically is what the experiment wound up as. The so-called ideal ground system consists of 120 equally spaced quarter wavelength radials that are used in the shunt-fed tower experiment. But even with such an elaborate ground plane as this, it still introduces 2 ohms of series loss resistance into the total radiation resistance. This is I'm reading exactly the article about shunt feeding the towers and what Jerry Civic contributed during that extensive experiment that was done with this fellow by the name of John Troop, N4BA. Dick, over.
K2JJ with a comment. Okay, K2JJ recognized. But let me, before I pass it over to you, JJ, say a couple more words on Gordon's original question. Turns out that Jerry Civic was working with short antennas, higher currents, therefore the amount of resistance left over from ground, in his case, like 2 ohms, was non-important because his radiation-resistant component may have been 2 ohms. Had he made the antenna longer, had he raised the antenna higher in the air, in either case, you get a benefit. The importance of the radials, how many you use, how close they're spaced, and whatever, that jazz all disappears when you mount the antenna X number of wavelengths above the ground. Take a look at any station master antenna, as they used to be called, these vertical collinear VHF antennas. You'll notice that they've got a great big long collinear radiator inside of that fiberglass tube, and the so-called ground plane system in that case, there's these three little stubby things coming off down at a 45-degree angle every 120 degrees in azimuth around the base. and that's there just to make sure you're not launching any current into the coax cable feeding it to the bottom. If you, the bottom line of that is, as you're able to raise your antenna X number of wavelengths above the ground, the ground plane radial system almost becomes unimportant. The so-called Ringo Ranger antenna has no radials at all. That's the good news. It's a nice, simple antenna. The bad news is you're launching current into your mounting structure, and two guys side by side in two adjacent buildings put up a Ringo Ranger, and one of them loves it and one of them hates it. Well, they have two slightly different lengths of pipe they're mounting it to. So that antenna is very sensitive to the length of pipe you mount it on, because it's launching current into that pipe, because it doesn't have ground plane radials. It's also launching current into your coax cable. That's not necessarily bad, but it's something you should know about. So the radial system slowly disappears in the requirement as you raise the whole antenna above the ground. That's one of my strongly felt opinions. K2JJ, put your spin on it, sir, K2RIW.
But this is shunt feeding towers, Dick.
Whether you shunt feed or base feed, that's just how you decide to do the impedance matching. The resonating structure that's doing the radiating, in both cases, I think is the same. You and I may have some differences of opinion on that one, Mel. we'll duke it out in the air here. I'll go over to Brooklyn and with some of my strong-armed guys, and I'll try to convince you that I'm right. I'm kidding here, fellas. Whether you shunt feed or base feed, I'll admit that you're using very different hardware, and you think you've got different antennas. I say that they're both the same antenna if the actual radiating structure is the same length. Whether you insulate it from the bottom and feed it there, or whether you ground it at the bottom and feed it somewhere higher up, one is easier to do than the other, but the radiation characteristics of the two, I think, are almost identical. And we'll have some more opinions on that. When the smoke settles, we'll find out what's going on, it says here. K2JJ, go right ahead. K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and all aboard. As far as the number of radials, I remember reading an article some years back, which was a treatise by Collins. Collins had done some experiments with, these were full-size vertical radiators, full-size vertical elements. I believe they were operating in the marine band around 2 megahertz. This was back in the 50s and 60s. They found that the point of diminishing returns was about 60 radials at those frequencies. Performance did increase slightly as you added more. However, the time and effort going beyond 66. So take that for what it's worth. Again.
Let me ask you, Doug, from your opinion on that data you were reading, do you believe that was full quarter-wave length antennas as opposed to these electrically shorter things that Jerry Civic was working with? Back to you, Doug.
Yeah, these were full-sized verticals, Dick. A very large coastal station, I believe, down in North Carolina. That they were. These were, oh, I forget the number of towers they had. There were several, maybe half a dozen or more, and they were being fed in and out of phase depending on how they wanted to do it. But each of them, as far as radials concerned, point of diminishing returns was at about 60 radials. They were full-sized quarter.
Darn good information. Thank you for that, Doug. In the case of broadcast stations, I don't know the exact laws on this, but I'll bet you the FCC requires something like 120 radials, a very extensive radial system. And there's about two or three things going on. One, they're trying to set a standard that's universal regardless of where your broadcast station is located. If your broadcast station is located right over a salty marsh and you've got the world's best ground conductivity, I suspect you could get away with 10 radials and get darn good performance. Another guy who's putting up his AM broadcast station in the Mojave Desert, on top of that sand, that extremely dry sand, where the ground conductivity is hard to measure, it's so damn low. There, the ground plane radial system is strongly required to be expensive if you want good efficiency out of that AM broadcast station. So I think they've set some universal rules with lots and lots of ground plane radials. Second of all, even if you've got medium conductivity local soil, depending on whether you're having a dry season or a wet season, a meager number of radials will have difference in performance. So if the FCC has given away this valuable resource to you They've given you a frequency you're allowed to use, given as, in quotes, you pay heavily, but you know what I mean. They want to make sure that you really do use it or lose it. And so they don't want their the listeners of that radio station to get a good signal some days and a bad signal on the dry days simply because you were putting down too few radio systems. So that's part of what's going on there. We amateurs don't have anywhere near such a restrictive rules. And if you want to put nothing but a ground rod into the ground and connect your coax cable to it and take the center conductor and connect it to the base of your antenna, which means you'll probably get about 70% loss and 30% radiation, which is not bad. It's X number of dB down. You're on the air. If you want to do that, the FCC and the ham radio laws will let you do it. And your fellow buddies will tell you from time to time that you're wasting quite a bit of power. You could be doing it better. Either raise it up in the air, make it a full half wave, vertical antenna, or lay down more radios. In either case, altitude helps, full half wave helps, a lot more ground plane radios help, and I also have a gut feel that by the time you've laid down 60 radios, I think you're getting 95% of the performance you're going to get if you lay down a million radios. But if you're a really serious guy, you got a whole lot of spare copper, ain't doing anything else, or spare aluminum, and you're willing to lay it in the ground, what the heck, go for it. And in the process, you may end up with a ground plane radio system that'll be gangbusters on not only 20 meters, 15 meters, and 10 meters. It may work like a charm on 80 meters and way down to 160 meters. So you pay your money, you take your choice. Let's see, who originally asked this question? I guess it was Frank. And look how much trouble you got us into here, Frank. W2MLB. K2RIW
on
the TechNet.
Comment deck, K2KY.
Hi, I got you in a lot of trouble, K2RIW in the net, K2MLB. Dick, because there's been so much divergence, let me just go back to a couple things. This fellow acknowledges all the work that Jerry Cervik did, and you hit on it exactly. All his work was, you know, with a 1/10 wavelength antenna, and everything he said was relative to a short top-loaded vertical. The point I wanted to make is that this study involved antennas from a tenth of a wavelength to one full wavelength in height, 1/10, 2, 3, 4, 5. He also had varying radials from a tenth of a wavelength to one full wavelength away, and he varied the number of radials in increments of 15, from 15 to 120. So the point is he studied the whole picture from the traditional, you know, quarter wave length radials that we consider ideal down to the shorter ones. And again, for all the reasons that you enumerated, the flow of current being greater nearer the base, et cetera, within a given radius, like me, if I'm limited to 60 feet, I would simply have more current total in a greater number of shorter radials than trying to get them out a quarter of a wavelength. Well, anyway, that was the point, and basically you confirmed really what the article showed. Terrific article, I thought, because he had things that I had never seen. All the graphs were related to varying antenna heights as well as radial lengths and number of number of radials.
K2KY.
Yeah, Mel recognized. I'm going to get to you in a second, Mel. I got a burning question here for Frank. Frank, you seem to have studied the material more recently than the rest, than at least I have. Maybe you don't have the answer yet, but here's my burning question. Do you see a trend that when you go from a tenth of a wave of shortened radiator up to 2/10, 4/10, 6/10, whatever, as the radiator gets longer, is the apparent requirement for the number of ground plane radials decreased? My gut feel is that as the radiator gets longer and longer, particularly as it approaches half wavelength in length, where the base current goes to near zero, even though you're loading power into it, that as you do that, I think the stringent requirements for the ground plane radio system decreases. So I wonder if you're seeing a trend like that, Frank, as you study that data. And if you're not sure right now, I'd be beholden to you if you did go back and see if there is that kind of trend. W2MLB, you got it, Frank, K2RIW.
K2MLB. Yeah, and you're right, Dick. Only because of what you had told me last week did I dig this article out. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known about it at all. The varying antenna heights that he goes from a tenth, actually he does a tenth of 0.15, a 2, a quarter, etc. In each case, as with one exception, which I'm going to ask you about only because we'll raise a further issue, regardless of the antenna height or the electrical length of the antenna, the current diminishes as you get further and further away from the base. Now, with the shorter electrical length, there's proportionately more current decreasing nearer the base because as the, you know, the longer electrical length is a gentler curve. But there's one very, very weird thing here. I say weird for me. Only in the case of a half-wave long vertical, a half-wave radio, vertical radiating element, at three-tenths of a wavelength away from the base, there is a maximum flow of current. In other words, the curve starts at the base, and instead of being greater at the base, it hits a maximum three-tenths of a wavelength away for some crazy reason. All the other curves are gentle and, you know, but this one, for a half wave, it does something strange, and I think we've spent, well, anyway, it's something for you to think about or tell us about. I have no idea.
Oh, I've got a beautiful answer for that one. But Mel's waiting in the wings, and I think we have another person, too. Mel first, K2KEY. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. What I'm quoting and what I'm reading here, we were talking about shunt fed towers. These are ground mounted towers with the gamma rod extending from the ground straight up the tower to the point of where it's joining the tower. This is not a short vertical that of the experiment that was done on here that I'm reading from. I know about Jerry Civic's short vertical experiment, but this was the experiment on shunt feeding towers. This is what I thought we were talking about. This is his quote for shunt fed towers of using it on 40 and 80 meters and 160, Dick. This is what I'm reading from, over.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions on that, Mel. Do you believe that by one means or another, each of those shunt fed towers were a quarter wave long on each of those frequencies, and how did he do that? Or was he choosing a single tower and trying to make it work on multiple frequencies by doing some magic with the gamma rod feeding system and the impedance matching system? Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Here's the description of what he was working with. Shows even the picture of the tower. It's a 50-foot tower with a Yagi, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 element Yagi on top, tri-band antenna, and he transforming it into an 80 and 160 meter radial. This is the system that they were working with, and this is the, I guess, the whole thing about their radio system, the measurements, the type of gamma rod, the size of it, 1 inch, they used 1 inch diameter rods, and what happened when they used smaller rods and wire feeders, you know, to feed it instead of with pipe, instead of making the gamma rod with pipe, they made it first out of wire. Oh, all kinds of different charts here, tremendous charts. Also, in discussions he had here with other people that used, for instance, a 45-foot tower with a high-gain TH-60XX and a two-element 40-meter beam on top, and what happens with that particular shunt feeding. So it was quite a detail here. There's a lot of information here about shunt feeding towers and the radial systems that are required. This has nothing to do with his short experiments with the short verticals. This is experiments on how to design shunted feed systems for grounded vertical radiators. This is for tower installation, a graphical design system for using your tower system as a shunt-fed vertical antenna. And that's what has nothing to do with his experiments on short verticals, Dick. This is strictly the experiments on ground-mounted towers. Over.
Okay. When I pass it back to you, Mel, I'm going to want to know the quote, I mean the reference there. What issue and what year was that being written? And I think it's by Jerry. And now, let me give you also my spin on what I think is happening here. He started off telling us about a 50-foot tower with a five-element beam on the top. If I was setting up a tower and I wanted it to be a quarter-wave, full-size radiator on 80 meters, where a half-wave dipole in 80 meters is something like 132 feet, and half of that is going to be something like 66 feet for quarter-wave. So a full tower, 60 feet tall, would be a nice 80-meter ground plane radiator. Because he's only got 50 feet and not 66, he's 16 feet shy. Because he is adding this five-element Yagi on the top, which is a great big top hat loading capacitor, I'll bet you he came very close to electrical resonance on 80 meters. Therefore, I'll bet you the degree of difficulty he ran into on 80 meters was very low. I'll bet you it was an easy feed. But when it comes to 160 meters, that same antenna now is no longer a quarter wave, it's an eighth wave. It's going to be very highly, with shunt feeding, it's going to look very highly inductive, and the radiation resistance is going to be very small. Therefore, the thickness of the pipe that he uses for the gamma rod is going to be important. I wonder, as you dig into that article, Mel, did you find out that all of his grief was finding ways of efficiently feeding it on 160 meters, and I'll bet you 80 meters was almost falling off a log by comparison. That's a guess on my part. And once again, tell us the issue and the year. K2KEY, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, he's got a whole thing here on the gamma rod, charts on the gamma rod, really, and showing how the gamma rod electrical height and the diameter of the rod affects, as you just said, the series capacitance of the system also. So there's charts and charts and charts here. It's quite detailed here. To read this, the entire thing is more to the shunt feeding of a tower. Meets the eye. This guy John True with Jerry Civic as his consultant, and it was Communications Quarterly, the fall issue of 1991. Yes, Communications Quarterly, fall issue 1991. Dick, over.
Check in. Okay, very good. Now, check in recognized, and it was one other person who wanted to make a comment, at least one other. Let's first have to find out, call it his name. Who is the check-in?
Dick, it's Koch, N2KDN. And if you could put me at the end of the list, I do have a question for the net when you get around to it, please. I'm enjoying this conversation, though, so please don't interrupt.
Okay, Koch. Let's see now. And who is the other person who wanted to make a comment? You have your opportunity now, sir.
KB2IUA.
KB2IUA, I think it is. Go right ahead. Start off with your name.
Good evening. Name here is John, and this is a subject that for years is very close to my heart as a chief engineer of AM broadcast stations. Yes, the 120 quarter-wave radials is the standard. They will let you get away with less under circumstances where you don't have the property. Also, what's not said in the rules, but it's common practice, is that there's usually a copper screen, a very heavy copper screen, that, depending upon the frequency, either a 20-foot square, which should be something, say, up from one megacycle up, or a 40-foot screen from one megacycle down, like the 540 AM on Long Island has a 40-foot square ground screen at the base, and then radials run out from that pretty much out to the property line, because they're very short east and west and long north and south. But one of the reasons, there's two things. One, it's extremely efficient. Two is stability. Those systems, the power is read what they call directly. That's what they call it. It's really indirect. Let me just drop it for, that's right, the tone's gone on. And since you read it by taking the amperage and the formula with the base current and the base impedance, and that's the way you figure your power. They want that base impedance to remain stable under different weather conditions, whether it's been raining a lot or whether it's been very dry. They want that base impedance and the base reactance to remain stable. So that's another reason for the 120 radials. And there was one other thing I was going to say, and now I'm trying to remember what it was. Also, those stations aren't tuned very often. Those stations might get, the base matching network may get adjusted every 4 or 5 years. So that's another reason that they're looking for the stability. One thing to keep in mind, Long Island, there's a wonderful map in Part 73 of the FCC rules that shows ground connectivity for all areas of the United States. And you don't have to go to the Mojave Desert for the worst ground connectivity in the United States. It's on Long Island, unless you're right on the coast. It is a 0.5, where other parts of the country are up to 20. Long Island is one of the worst ground connectivities in the country. Back to net control. KB2IUA.
Hey, John, you're a fun guy to talk to. Good information. I'd love to know which broadcast station, I'm guessing they might be AM broadcast stations, you're associated with, if you can tell us. Back to you, John.
Okay, well, for, let's see, 22 years, I was with 540 AM. Many of those years, it was a 500-watt non-directional with a 1/6 wave tower. And while I was there, I did design the current two-tower directional. The other station up until about a year and a half ago was WHLI, and that was a bit more interesting with 10,000 watts doing strange things around the site. But it is convenient sometimes just to be able to hold up a fluorescent tube and have it light up in your hands while you're making adjustments.
Fun stuff. We amateurs just love doing that. One of the things I liked doing in the old days is to draw a pencil lock from my 20-meter, my pair of 807s on 40 meters. I could draw a nice long pencil lock off the plate cap. John, I wonder if you're the guy that I met face-to-face. I know it was a station engineer and the station owner from the 540 station, visited us at Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I'm going to make a guess, 1996 or so. Stereo and things like that were being added, and he was asking questions along the lines of, is there anything I can do to my ground plane radial system? Is there anything I can do to increase the efficiency of the system? I'm not getting quite the coverage I wanted out of the 500 watts I've got available. And so I wonder if you were present on that meeting, that me, Larry Oliva, and a couple of other guys were there. I wonder if you were one of those people in that meeting, in which case, John, maybe you and I met face-to-face. WB2IUA, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KB2IUA. I don't remember that particular meeting. That could have been after I left, because I know we were looking at options. They had improved the ground radial system by then. They did that when he purchased the station, and they had gone stereo. But I don't remember that particular meeting. Currently I'm no longer in broadcast radio. What I'm doing is maintaining the camera and microwave network for Metro and Shadow Traffic here in New York, working with Westwood One, including the two cameras on the outside of the Empire State Building up at 87 and 88.
You got a fun job. Fantastic. A bunch of us would like to do what you're doing, John. Okay. So some of my speculations apparently are being confirmed, that broadcast has rules where they really would like lots and lots of ground plane radios to make sure you're really using your frequency allocation to its full benefit for whatever number of watts the station was licensed to. And notice, fellas, that I've heard about this for years and years, that many, many AM broadcast stations confirm what power they're radiating out into the air by measuring the RF current that's fed into the tower. And in many cases, they keep a logbook, and They write down the current X number of hours or X number of times per day and so on, confirming that the right power, particularly where many stations who don't have a full clear channel are not allowed to transmit full power at night. They have to go down to a lower power. And I'm going to turn it back to John for a quick question on that. I bet you the 540 was required to change power after dusk at nighttime versus daytime. Is that somewhat true, John? KB2IUA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Just letting the ID go past. KB2IUA here. Yes, they were. Originally, they were a day timer, and they signed off at local sunset. Later, they were allowed, I remember this now, 204 watts, and we couldn't get the transmitter down to that low a power. They were normally 250, and we made a power divider to send some of the power to a dummy load and the remainder out to the tower and still maintain the proper impedance on the transmitter. I think, well, currently, it's a two-tower directional with a null towards Pocomo City, where there's another 540 on the same frequency. That null holds the 250-watt power level, basically, the same efficiency there. The rest of it, it was allowed to expand, and that's a 2,500-watt signal. But at night, it has to drop down, I believe, it's a bit more than 204 watts now. It could be like 234 or something. And unfortunately, I've just pulled up. I may hear some of it, but I'm going to be have to go clear here. This is KB2IUA. Listening out.
Thank you, John. Wish you'd sign in more frequently. And man, what academicness is going on here. If your license was at nighttime for 250 watts, 204 watts, and you could only get it down to 250, the difference is 8/10 of a dB. It takes laboratory equipment at the receiver site for the listener to know the difference. Yeah, I know the other broadcast station at 540 you're sharing the frequency with. In theory, that extra one whole dB of extra power gives him a little bit more grief. But I think we're way into the nitty-gritty here, is my opinion. For us amateurs to understand this, we're talking about a little more than 8/10 of an S unit of difference in signal strength. Now, wait a minute now. Oh, wait a minute. Almost point. Yeah, we're talking about a few percent of an S unit of difference in signal strength of 204 watts versus 250. And you guys being so painfully honest, worried about dissipating the other 46 watts. Craziness. Okay. We're having fun with antennas. The base-loaded antennas tonight are the subject that we're discussing quite a bit, and how many radials and how you feed it and how high it should be and so on. It all comes down to you resonate first, and that's what allows you to radiate. We all like to believe that, hey, I've got this halfway dipole in space. I launched some power into it with 72-ohm twin lead. It's a 72-ohm diode with dipole. We like to believe the RF energy flows down the wire, jumps out into space, and that's radiation. Absolutely, positively not. You get deep enough into it, and none of the books make this clear, none of the courses make this clear, that RF energy, an extremely small percentage of it, maybe 1 or 2%, radiates by the time that radio wave you launched on the center of the dipole spreads all the way to the tips of the dipole, those egg insulators on the outside. By the time it gets there the first time, only a couple of percent of it radiated. Most, 98% of it or so, is still there. All that energy reflects back to the center. And the bottom line is your signal bounces back and forth on your dipole something like 30 times before it finally is radiated into space. When you and I are electrically resonating our antenna, making it the right length or using the right antenna tuner or matching network or whatever, we're making sure that all of those 30 bounces stay co-phased. That's what we're really doing. That's why the antenna jumps up into such high reactance so fast if you make it too short or too long, electronically speaking. It starts jumping way high in the impedance bound, becoming very reactive, because what reactive really means is there's a phase shift. And so all those bounces start falling out of phase with each other, and you sense it as reactive current when you measure the impedance with your network analyzer, your impedance measuring analyzer, your antenna your antenna analyzer, whatever you call it. It's amazing to me how many antenna engineers have not realized that the wire itself of a dipole, my dipole, I got 72 ohm feed line, twin lead, feeding this ideal dipole, it's got 72 ohm impedance, and I call it 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. From the viewpoint of the transmission line, it's 1-to-1. On the wire itself that's doing the radiating, the real standing wave ratio out there is probably 100-to-1. The signal is bouncing back and forth a whole lot of times. And so now you know why resonance of some form seems to be so darn important. Okay, I've probably created some questions by all this. Fire away. Who would like to talk some more? Give me your call. It is a name right now. KQRIW.
Dick, you want the anecdotal reason why they use 120 radio?
Let's have it.
Basically, the FCC picked 120 radios because the George Brown study determined that. Somewhere, I don't remember where, many years ago, he was asked, how did he get 120 radials, you know, that he divide 360 degrees by 120, whatever. He told a story, as I remember it. They were out in, wherever they were doing the test was, I'm going to say, the Midwest flat, and he had contracted with a farmer and a tractor to cut the slits in for the radials. So he went out that day, and the farmer says, well, you know, what am I going to do, or where do we go? And George Brown looked at the amount of wire that he had, knew the length that he wanted, and it came out to 120 based on the amount of wire, and it seemed like a good number, and supposedly that's how we ended up with 120 radials.
So he took 360 degrees, divided by 3, ended up with 120, did a calculation, he had the right amount of wire. It's an easy way geometrically, in other words, with his protractor, he could easily lay out which direction he wanted the farmer to go and plow the furrows where he's going to sink the wire, and that became our standard. Which reminds me of the wagon trails they used to have in Rome way back in the Dark Ages became the modern day streets. So many things have got some strange origins. You were reading that from what reference, Frank? It sounds like a beauty. Go ahead, Frank.
The story about George Brown, I don't remember, to be honest, Dick. That's something I read somewhere, you know, years ago, and it just came back to me now. Do you mean the reference about the study that I was just referring to this week?
Yeah, go ahead. Give us any of the references you got, Frank.
Yeah, well, this is an article that is from the July 2000 QST. And it was written by Rudy Servins, N6LF. And as I say, I had just never quite seen that data, you know, similar to Jerry's, extrapolated to different lengths of antennas, etc. Very, very, very interesting, I found it.
Yeah, fascinating.
WW.
Okay, Howie, go ahead and tell us what you believe is going on here.
I don't want to ask that. Did you get an email from me on speed of light?
I haven't... I was away at meetings all day today, which is crazy, on Sunday. I was working. And so I haven't seen my email in the last three quarters of a day, Howie. Roughly how long ago did you send it?
Last Tuesday or Wednesday. It was about that they found that on the certain conditions, which I don't believe, that they were able to measure the speed of radio waves going faster than the speed of light in a waveguide. I don't know if you got that email. It was up from Tuesday or Wednesday of this week.
I've seen articles on that exact subject. I don't know if I've got your particular email. And by the way, I'm now getting close to 400 pieces of spam per day. And I think it's because of my website for my consulting business. It's an easy thing for these guys to latch onto. And boy, am I being spammed. And to tolerate 400 pieces of spam per day would be very tough. My son, a computer whiz, added a Bayesian filter. And... maybe it's a little bit severe at times, but of those 400 pieces of spam, only one per day gets through. That's the good news. And the bad news is one per day of my friends get rejected, and I have to go look in the reject file before they get dumped to make sure that they don't go into the circular file and I catch my friends. So a little bit of that's going on. I'm getting 400 pieces of spam per day, and if I plotted a curve of how fast it's increasing, it's alarming. My system is going to be wasting kilowatts of power handling all this spam just coming into my house, if you know what I mean. So, okay, The subject tonight is a ground plane vertical antennas and the right number of radials and how you mount them and how you feed them and so on. Fun subject. Of the people who signed in who definitely had a question, and I guess Kaj has got one, except for Kaj, have I missed anyone that originally signed in who said it as a question, had a question? If so, speak up now, please.
KV1OQD.
Okay, go right ahead, Bob.
Thank you, Dick. I'll make it quick there. I got to sign off soon. So, I got a log periodic antenna made by Elk Antennas there. Manufacturer turned around and says that it should be placed on PVC piping at least 4 feet from any metal objects there. Is the first question I have, and about a DC power pack I'm looking to get for turn my mobile into a base here. I'm looking at switching and then regulated power packs, and I need to know which is the two of the best, because I'm hearing some conflicting stories about hums and noises and interference on some of the frequencies there. But like I said, there one is about the antenna and then one is power pack.
Yeah, let me take the first one first. I'm assuming the log periodic antenna is not being mounted on your automobile. Very few people would do that. I'm assuming it's a home installation. And where they told you to mount it on PVC pipe and keep it 4 feet away from any pieces of metal, either the person who wrote that has very little understanding or somebody is being extremely severe. Assuming that you're using your log periodic as a horizontally polarized antenna, and you might be setting it up vertical, but assuming it's horizontal, any vertical piece of pipe is not there. It's cross-polarized to the wave you're emitting, and unless it's shorting out the crisscross wiring that goes down your log, if it's that particular kind of log feeding mechanism, except for your wire shorting, your pipe shorting out those wires, nothing would happen. So, in my opinion, that manufacturer is saying things much too severe. Many manufacturers will put things like this, crazy stringent requirements. If you come back and complain to them that ain't giving full performance, because they put these crazy things in the owner's manual, they can point to that chapter and say, chapter and verse, you didn't follow our rules, therefore all bets are off and you got no complaint. I think some of that is going on. Also, the guy who writes the owner's manual may not be the guy who did the original design. He may have done that 10 years ago. He's no longer with the company. He's retired. He's working for some other place. And so he's not around to tell people what the truth of the situation is. And the guy left over to write the manual takes whatever old wives' tales he's got about antenna installations and puts it in the manual. Some of that's going on, but that requirement sounds much too stringent. When it comes to the DC power pack, I've got no information on that one. Maybe Mel does, although we tend to be a little bit reluctant to recommend and de-recommend certain brand names. However, when it comes to generic switching-type power supply, which versus non-switching type power supply, I bet you Mel's got some opinions. So let me pass over to Mel and see if he's got one on this one. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, I had experience, in fact, with one switching power supply. You got to be careful. A lot of them that are bargains, you see a lot of bargains, very cheap switching power supplies around. And then you listen on your HF radio, and you find that many times you say, what the heck is that? When you're listening to very weak signals and the band is somewhat quiet, you hear something in there and you say, what is that? It sounds like, well, I won't call it a 60-cycle hum because it's definitely not 60 cycles. It's most likely part of whatever frequency they're raising it up to. Now, many of these switching power supplies are running between 100 and 300 kilohertz. So you have a tendency sometimes for it to get into the radio. So if it's a well-designed switching power supply, there's no problem with it. Unfortunately, to build a good one like I did, I built one, a 40-amp one that was designed by our friend Dick. You know, the guy in Chile at the observatory up there. What the heck is the name? You know what I'm talking about. He designed one extremely well and takes quite a bit to build such a thing, but it is phenomenal. I still have my original power supply, which was just using pass transistors with a big power transformer, but I needed something a little bit more portable, at the time, and I needed the current rating, so I did build that switching power supply that he had the article in the magazine, excellent design and all. But you got to be careful, like I say, about the economy ones. They sometimes will give you some problems, Dick, over.
Comment, WB2HWW.
Howie recognized, and I've got a big comment first. What Mel is referring to, the person Mel is referring to, is XQ2FOD. XQ, I think it's XQ2, but it's FOD. Manfred Mornhinweg. That's the engineer from La Salina, Chile, who works for the European Southern Observatory. That is an engineer. You look at that particular power supply, which was in two separate chunks of QST Magazine, December issue 1999, and I think it was the January issue of 2000. That is a hell of an engineer, one hell of a power supply, switching power supply, extremely efficient, extremely good at self-protecting, and so on. And your first expression when you look at that power supply design in those issues, you'll say, why the hell does it have so many components? You start reading his article, or you write him an email, and you get the real full article, because they couldn't print it all in the magazine. He justifies why every single component is there. He could take that particular power supply. He could take the antenna wire out of his Collins receiver, wrap it around the 12-volt lead coming out of this 50-ampere 12-volt power supply while it's producing full current. He wraps his antenna around the wire of the power supply, and he scans across all the ham bands, and he can't find any signals. That machine is quiet. That is a real good switching power supply design. So when it comes to switching power supply design, there are switchers and there are switches. That's part of what Mel's saying. There's some damn good ones. Maybe you can't buy them as good as that one by Manfred Mornhinweg, or you can get some pretty yucky ones. So should you outlaw all switching power supplies for your shack? Of course not. There's some darn good ones, as you can tell. So maybe that helps a little bit. Let me turn it back to you, Bob. KB1OQD, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, all right. Thank you very much, Dick, there, Mel. Okay, like I said, you know, the manufacturer, I talked to the two guys there that are still manufacturing this antenna out there in California, like I said, Delk antenna. Had some really good reviews. There's a guy up there, Hudson Valley there, was hitting, I guess, your repeaters down there, at least close to 50 miles away. And I think I'm talking about 15 watts on here, and it's only 6 feet up in the air off my back patio, like I said, and I'm in a valley by Westchester Airport here. And I guess you guys are hearing me, and so far I'm happy. I'm just curious because if I do want to put it on an extended pole there as far as getting it up a little higher in some areas than I am, because I'm looking for portability, that's, you know, why it's not set up on the house or anything, that if I use something like a swimming pool extendable vacuum pole there that, you know, I can throw in the truck there, you know, just to get it up higher. But I just wonder if the metal there. And like I said, I'm going to end up purchasing a DC power pack, and I'm just reading a lot of things on it now, and I see the prices of them going up since I bought a Vista years ago. I'm seeing the prices that they are now, but, you know, I want to make a one-time purchase there. But anyway, I want to thank you both there very much, and everybody on this channel there and Limart there. Like I said, I've been listening to you guys for some time until I got my ticket to talking. Nice bunch of guys out there, and I appreciate all the help from everybody, especially Bob out there for the manual, if you're listening there. We're going to sign now there. And everybody have a good evening. KB1OQD, we'll be signing clear.
Okay. Sounds like we got another happy customer there. Mel, we got to send him a bill. The invoice is in the mail, Bob. Okay. Howie, I know you wanted to make a comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick. I had a Samlex, which is a pretty expensive commercial supply that we used, cost about $500, switching supply 100 amps. I had it on a repeater, and it gave me more grief than you could believe. It was a classic linear supply with a lot of fans on it. Problem was, it when we had it hooked up to the transmitter, up to the whole station, we were bothering people on either side of us for a few hundred kc's. Every 50 or 60 kc's, we had a spark. Very interesting. We tried running batteries in parallel. We tried shielding it. We tried putting low-pass filters, choke filters. and we just could not get whatever this was with crud far enough down. On a spectrum analyzer, if you looked at it, down 70 or 80 dBs, you would see little spars on the carrier. Go ahead.
K2JJ with a comment.
Yo, I believe it, Howie. Doug, I bet you've got another horror story. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, same supply deck, and here's a very interesting thing that I found. That thing put out little birdies on 80 meters about every 40, 50 kc. One day I opened it up, on the output end of it, silk screened on the board itself, were two capacitors and one inductor. They were not installed. They were jumpered out. But if you went to the parts list, it said C14, C24, whatever it was, sold them, problem went away.
Interesting piece of information. Sounds like somebody was cutting corners. Did you buy it brand new, Doug, or had you bought one that possibly was modified by somebody?
No, brand new supply deck, right out of the box. These looked like they were, jumpered at the factory.
A question to the station.
Howie's got a question for Doug. Go ahead, Howie.
Doug, this was a Samlex, because I have a Samlex. It's 100 ampere. Are you talking about this one? The one I have has individual cards. Each one is a 20 ampere. Five of them will give you 100 amps. Was this on the individual card, or was this on the main board where you have the bus and you have the battery charging circuit?
No, different supply, Howie. Same company, though. This was a small supply, a little 20-amp supply, but same company.
Yeah. Lately, I've been doing an experiment at the salt mine with a 100-ampere, 28-volt switching-type supply. And if you had built that in the old days by conventional transformer, rectifier, and whatever, and regulated, boy, would that be a master, a massive thing. And nowadays, all of those kilowatts of power can be supplied in a very small package. And there are switching supplies and there are switching supplies. There can be huge differences between the electromagnetic interference they create, the efficiency between the brand names, and so on. There are some switching power supplies out there that as they flip back and forth with their push-pull transistors, where it goes through a transitional period where it makes a burst of RF energy on each transition. And if you've got one of those, my goodness, you have an uncalibrated frequency marker. Every 30 kc or whatever up the band is going to give you a nice strong signal that squitters around. So I like switching power supplies when they're properly designed. QED. Okay, Kaj, I think it was N2 KDN, I think it is. Go right ahead with your question, Kaj. K2RIW, my name is Dick. W-O-2-Z, like chicken. W-O-2-Z, I think it is. We got you, sir. Kaj, go ahead first.
Okay, thanks, Dick. Sort of switch the subject in a way. Going to be putting a HF rig into my sailboat. And I know, of course, you got to have proper RF grounding. What I'm wondering is, I'm getting ready to put the boat in, and I do not have, they're called porous brass plates that you bolt through the hull to maintain a good RF contact with the water. Should I hold off dropping the boat in to getting one of those installed, or I have a bond, the bonding system going through the engine, the shaft, into the water for electrolysis and DC grounding and stuff like that is very good. Will that serve the purpose for now until I haul out again next year? Is it going to be a tremendous lack of RF grounding, would you think, by not going to one of the larger plates, or is it just going to be a small difference in my transmission?
Yeah. Part of what we're talking about here is galvanic action, dissimilar metals, seawater, and whatever, and protecting your boat. Part of what we're talking about is a grounding system if you're using a unbalanced kind of a antenna on the boat. Part of what we're talking about is human safety. Let me start off with human safety. When it comes to a shack, maybe a little bit also true when it comes to a sailboat, grounding, the main reason for grounding, is to protect human beings. If something goes wrong with your rig and the hot side of the 110-volt line decides to touch the chassis and your rig is not properly grounded by the so-called neutral system and your other auxiliary grounding, then the chassis can be caught hot with 120 volts. You touch that chassis, you touch a water pipe, and you might be history. Nowadays, many of our